Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Good morning, everybody. Could I just say, first of all, a big congratulations and a thank you to everybody who's helped to organise this event. I think it is a very important and significant event, and it's a great honour for me to be here. Could I then go on to apologise for the fact that, unfortunately, I won't be able to stay as long as I would like to, as I have undertaken to give evidence on cycling at 11 o'clock back in the House of Commons. So, unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to stay for two speeches which I would have loved. Well, in fact, there are many speeches, many people I'd like to have heard from, but I hope that Professors Marmot and McCormick will forgive me that I can't stay. I had particularly wanted to stay, but unfortunately I have this other engagement. I don't want to speak for too long, because I do actually want to take questions from everybody and anybody in the room, and I don't know whether we have the ability to take questions from other parts of the United Kingdom. But if that's possible, I don't have a problem with that either. And I just wanted to say by way of background that until 2010, I was a practicing criminal barrister in Nottingham. I also used to work in Derby, Leicester and Lincoln, but I was basically centred in Nottingham where my chambers were. And as a criminal barrister, I mainly defended. I defended 80% of the time, and only 20% of the time did I prosecute. So if I may say, I'm well familiar with, I was going to say, the plight, and I think it is a plight, for many people who are homeless. Many of my clients were homeless. During my time in Nottingham, I had what was a great honour to go to one of the night shelters that we run in the city. And the city of Nottingham over the years has done a lot of work to try to reduce certainly the number of rough sleepers and overall numbers of people who are homeless. So it's an area of work which I am familiar with, though I wouldn't begin to claim to have the level and degree of knowledge and expertise that I suspect the overwhelming majority of people in this room and beyond have. So my job, frankly, is to listen and learn from you, as opposed to try and tell you the stuff that you already know. But I did just want to remind everybody of the figures. Life expectancy in Britain has increased, and we should be very proud of that. The life expectancy for a man is 78, just over 78 years of age, and for a woman, it's now 82 years of age. If you live in the borough of Kensington and Chelsea, you can expect to live, if you are a woman, until you are 85. But if you are of the same sex and you live in Blackpool, you could expect your life expectancy will be 73 years of age now. Many of you know what this is all about. It's about inequalities, health inequalities. And in the world of the homeless, the average age of death, according to a survey conducted by Crisis, for a woman, the average age of death is 43, and for a man, it is 47. And that compares with the rest of the population, 74, the average age of death for a man, and 80 for a woman. So I think those very stark figures really, truthfully, say it all. Understanding and appreciating the desperate need to improve health inequalities, which, it's not a party political point, have grown, despite, it has to be said, the efforts of previous governments, but they actually have increased in recent years. And it was one of the reasons that increase that when we introduced and then finally passed the highly controversial Health and Social Care Bill, and I have no intentions of going into the detail of it, other than to say everybody should be pleased and should recognise that there is now a statutory duty on the Secretary of State, on the NHS Commissioning Board, and on Clinical Commissioning Groups, CCGs, a statutory duty to reduce health inequalities. And that duty extends to everybody who resides in England. And that includes everybody, even if they are not registered with a GP or they are not a patient anywhere. So that is an absolute duty. And it includes the duties of reporting back annually and making sure that services are joined up to make sure that the very best is achieved to reduce health inequalities. And I look forward to reading and knowing and understanding those annual reports from the Secretary of State, my boss, from the NHS Commissioning Board, and from CCGs, as to the work that they are doing to reduce health inequalities. I just want to mention, of course, that what the Act also did was that it took public health away from a national level and gave it back to where it had always been, and where, in my view, it should have been and should have remained, which is at a local level with local authorities. And if anybody doubts the abilities of local authorities to deliver on the big public health issues, I would refer you to the statistics that were announced yesterday on teenage pregnancies. And yesterday's results showed the sort of work that local authorities are more than capable of doing. Because local authorities, with the work that they've done on teenage pregnancy rates, now mean that we have the lowest teenage pregnancy rates that we've seen in 40 years. So all that hard work, all that graft, all the difficulties that were faced at last have been seriously overcome. And that's largely because of the work of local authorities and working in collaboration and cooperation with all the other agencies that needed to be done. And I know that health and wellbeing boards, in their shadow form, soon to be up and running in full form, have had to look at them and assess the needs of their areas and their communities. And in so doing, they too have to be aware of what they will do to reduce health inequalities. And in reducing health inequalities, what we know we have to do is to get into those areas of our population who have traditionally been the most difficult to get into, because it is the case that often it is the most needy, the most deprived members of our society who actually, ironically, have the poorest levels of health services and indeed other services. And I'm very proud that I'm the minister with responsibility for the Inclusion Health Programme. And I know that, and I know you're going to hear from Steve Field later on this morning, but I know that the focus are those very, very groups who are in most need, where there is so much inequality that we need to do the most work with. Especially gypsies and travellers, prostitutes, forgive me, I don't use the word sex worker. I have represented over the years, or indeed prosecuted, many prostitutes, and I have never met a prostitute who hasn't been seriously abused at some stage in their lives, usually as children. And I don't see that, the fact you are a prostitute, as some sort of career choice. And it's not because I'm in any way being derogatory at all, far from it. I think that that group of people are some of the most vulnerable people in our society and deserve the very best of services. And I know that many areas work really well with street prostitutes, and rightly so, but it's certainly one of those groups where we need to do a considerable more amount of work to improve their health outcomes. And if we help those women to regain their self-confidence and their self-esteem and find another way of living, then it's absolutely admirable and it must be done. And of course, the other group who we know have poor health outcomes, who deserve the very best, are not only vulnerable migrants, but also the homeless. And I've already given examples of the outcomes that face people who are homeless, and you all know why those outcomes are often as they are. We know that often GPs are criticised for refusing to register the homeless, and that, of course, means that they have poor access to primary healthcare services and hospital discharge arrangements. We know that homeless people are entitled to access NHS primary medical services in the same way as everyone else in this country. And GP practices are expected to register homeless patients, and homelessness is not a reasonable ground to refuse to register a person as an NHS patient. And I am also, of course, aware of the really brilliant and great work that many of our GP practices, and I've just got a bit of a flavour of some of the work that's going on in Hackney. I met somebody I haven't seen for about 20 years who's also involved in that work. But I'm only using Hackney because I happen to have met them. But I know that there are many other areas of the country where great work is being done by GP practices. We've now got to make sure that that is rolled out across the whole of England. But we are looking into GP registration and primary care access to establish what actually is happening and why. And we'll be discussing our findings with the NHS Commissioning Board, as the Commissioning Board will be responsible for the commissioning of primary care services in April. I just want to deal, finally, with hospital discharge. Last year, the Department of Health commissioned a piece of work from Homeless Link and St Mungo's to look at how to improve hospital admissions and discharge for people who are homeless. And I had the great pleasure of going to St Mungo's just before Christmas, and he's here. I can just see you. Hello. But knowing of the great work that not only do they do now, but what they want to do to improve what is undoubtedly a failing system. And I know that the report that was published in May of last year simply paints an unacceptable picture, with people being considered so supposedly fit for discharge without their housing and wider support needs being taken into account. And just one example, somebody being discharged from a hospital back onto the streets in his pyjamas with nothing on his feet. It's unacceptable. I wish that was one remarkable example. Very rare, but in fact the report found that 70% of homeless people had been discharged from hospital back onto the streets. So unfortunately, that is not an isolated incident. On the other hand, of course, there are many examples. There's a great one in York where the Salvation Army and the local hospital have set up an arrangement where the hospital can call the Salvation Army's early intervention team and prevention team when a homeless person presents. So that there are other examples. I know that there are some that Pathways been involved in, and I know that in Liverpool, the Royal Hospital there has also been working with other agencies to make sure that homeless people, when they are discharged from hospital, are getting the right sort of support and treatment that they need. But there's much more that we should and could and want to do. And I hope to be able to be in a position very soon to make an announcement as to what we intend to do as a government and funding that we might be able to make available so that we can help the voluntary sector to improve hospital discharge arrangements between health, local authority and voluntary services, and to help secure appropriate facilities for those requiring continuing medical support after hospital discharge to allow time for recovery. I'm not in a position today to make any announcement, but I'm very hopeful that I will in the next few weeks, if not a bit longer, be in a position to make a sort of announcement that might ensure that my new friends at St Mungo's become my lifelong friends at St Mungo's and all the other charities that do such great work. So, in short, if you want to be blunt about it, there are now no excuses for anybody involved in the health service, and that includes locally and nationally, and that includes government, to allow a continuation of the health inequalities and the poorness of services, especially for those people who are homeless. We have now the statutory duties in place. We've got all the other mechanisms in place. What we now need to do is build on our knowledge and that duty and get on and deliver in a way that perhaps we haven't in the past, to make sure that because you are homeless doesn't mean to say that you haven't got the absolute right to the very finest treatment, just like anybody else in our society. So I'm very happy now, please, to take questions.
Just to remind everyone, wait for the microphone, stand up, just say your name. And for those of you who are watching online, don't forget to push the little question button on your speaker. Yes.
Stan Burridge, research lead for Pathway. Thanks for your speech. If you just forgive me and indulge me for a little bit, can you just tell me how many of your predecessors you can name?
How many of my predecessors? Ministers of Public Health?
Of Ministers of Public Health. It's not a test. You're not on the spot.
Anne Milton, Dawn Primarola. Actually, Edwina Curry. A lot of people here will be old enough to remember Edwina Curry was a Minister for Public Health. Who else was a Minister for Public Health? I don't think I can remember.
You're doing better than I expected anyway. to be honest. And the reason why I ask that question is because I don't think that we can remember very many of them. And I would like to suggest that as perhaps because they haven't done anything of note. Anything that's memorable. I think you have an opportunity now with these people here, and certainly with the model of care that we offer at Pathway, with the medical respite model, which I'd like to leave you with these documents to take away with you, to really make a change and change the landscape for homeless people for a long time in the future. It's something which, you know, I think you should give consideration to. You have said you're not in a position to make an announcement today, but I think that you should take it seriously and have a look at it. It is a model that you are looking to continue with, providing aftercare, medical aftercare. It's something that we've worked on very closely with many of our colleagues. And just before I finish, I would just pick something up, really, that you actually said. There was a line that you said, it was something that Pathway had been involved in. I would like to remind you that Pathway was awarded the HSJ Patient Centre Care Award for 2012, and I think that should be acknowledged, the hard work that the Pathway team have put in there. Thank you.
Thank you. You didn't ask a question, which I'm not complaining about, because it means I don't have to give an answer. You've made some great points extremely well. Cheers. Thank you. No, lovely, thank you. I think I'll be taking a trip to Pathway, actually. I shall now get into terrible trouble because I'll have to promise to go and see everybody's work. But then I've been to St Mungo's, so there's no reason why I shouldn't come and see the great work that you guys are doing. So thank you for that.
Other questions here?
Hi, I'm Dr. Justin Varney. I'm a consultant in public health medicine. You've raised the issue about what I would view as clinical neglect and negligence in terms of discharging patients onto the street from hospital. And after the Francis report and mid-staffs, and similar issues for patients with learning difficulties, how do you think we can change the culture of practitioners and actually reframe homelessness in the way that child protection was successfully done so that we're not putting vulnerable adults onto the street with clinical conditions and actually taking responsibility for their care properly?
Well, I think you're right. And I think that's one of the things that that conferences like this are doing. And I think within the professions, if I may say, I think there's a raising of awareness. I mean, I actually take the view, I'm going to believe that nobody deliberately decides to discharge somebody with no shoes on, nothing on their feet, and in a pair of pyjamas. I'm going to take that view, that nobody does that deliberately. Circumstances often come into play. But everybody has to wake up to the fact that that cannot ever be the right thing to do. I mean, it is blisteringly obvious to most of us, but often busy A&E departments, no doubt. Often it's pressure on beds may mean that somebody just isn't engaging what I know they have within them, because they wouldn't have become a health professional in the first place, which was their compassion and their wanting to do the best for somebody, especially when somebody wasn't very well. But most importantly, if you haven't got the facilities for somewhere to go, if you haven't already started that intervention work, then in a way, what the hell else do you expect? And you can't blame staff if we aren't providing the facilities. And that's one of the reasons why we've looked at very carefully how we can do these sorts of places, an extension of hostels it may well be, or other work that I know the voluntary sector wants to do, the great charities want to do, so that when somebody is discharged, before they are discharged, because it's a great point of contact when somebody's in a hospital bed who is homeless, to be able to look at all their needs, including the fact, of course, that they are homeless, to make sure that when they are discharged from hospital, they're going literally to a better place, but also a place that's got tons of support to help them to change their lives.
Hello, I'm Angela Burnett from the Greenhouse Practice in Hackney and Freedom from Torture. Thank you for your talk. And I wanted to ask you, in your capacity as Minister of Public Health, how you will be able to link with other government departments, in particular housing and also welfare benefits. Because, of course, if we could actually prevent homelessness and actually have people housed, then many of the health problems and early deaths that people are experiencing would actually be helped greatly. So it requires a lot of joined-up thinking and action.
Absolutely. I'm one of the members of what we call the Interministerial Group on Homelessness, and it involves exactly those people, not just the minister with responsibility for housing, but also representatives from local government, obviously myself from health, somebody from DWP, and all the other departments that you would expect to be involved in looking at the problem of homelessness. And when we meet, we discuss exactly those issues that you've identified. And one of the reasons why we moved public health back to local authorities, there are two reasons. One reason is because we think local authorities are best placed to know and understand the needs of their communities, because with few exceptions, that's what they want to do. They want to serve their local communities. And also, by putting them back down to local government, it means that many of those very people that you've identified at a local level already sit under the umbrella within a local authority. Not always, because you've got a shire county, you've got to link up with the boroughs, because they're responsible for planning, they're responsible for housing and leisure, for example. But taking it back down to local government means that you have a considerably better chance of putting everybody to get together, to work together, in the very way that you describe.
Hi, I'm Zoe Matthews from Friends, Families and Travellers and a trustee of National Voices. It really follows on from the point the previous lady made, which is we know that there's an estimated 25,000 homeless gypsies and travellers who are just pushed around the country from pillar to post with nowhere to legally stop. Whilst, you know, obviously this requires joined up thinking, and whilst you're speaking about the advantages of things being localised, it's not a popular local cause and requires a lot of input from the top, because when it comes down to it, always the government can put money forward for sites. Always there are barriers, you know, they're planning obstacles. It just doesn't happen. So localization doesn't work terribly well for gypsies and travellers in that respect.
No, I agree with you that there have been profound difficulties. I think the fact that there is a statutory duty now to reduce health inequalities, and we know the huge health inequalities between travellers and gypsies and the rest of the community, that I believe, will be a driver, that local authorities will wake up to the fact that they have now got to deliver. And whilst this is not the sort of thing for this audience, because you are not a party political audience, but one of the things that I say when I go, like I did yesterday, to a meeting of the Local Government Association where there are councillors, I don't want it to become a party political issue. I mean, for goodness sakes, it shouldn't be. But I do want it to become a political issue in this way. I want to see the various councillors, the political parties at a local level, when they are standing for re-election, just like they put recycling rates on their leaflets to say, vote for me because I've done this on recycling. I want them, and it is arguably considerably more important, to put on their leaflets, this is what we've achieved for our community, for you, in the 4 years of our office, in terms of what we've delivered on for the improvement of the health and well-being of the people in this particular ward. Because people will soon have access to a level of information at a really drilled down local level. So the public will have access to it, but I want politicians to understand that they have a duty now to improve, as I think many of them do. I mean, most people come into politics for the best of intentions. You can criticise us that we don't deliver on it, but our intentions are invariably honourable. And for local councillors, this is a real opportunity to make a real difference. And that also means setting aside any prejudices that they may have, not just with gypsies and travellers, but even in the delivery of sexual health policy, which again is a responsibility of local government. There will be no nonsenses tolerated. I know Duncan Selby, and I know he's speaking later on, he won't take any nonsenses on this either, and neither will we as government. If there is any hint of any sort of prejudice in making sure that it doesn't matter who you are entitled to the very best services, and that includes particularly health services.
Andrew Hayward from University College London. I was wondering if we could get your thoughts on how we can commission services for homeless people and other disadvantaged groups that have a footprints that are much larger than a clinical commissioning group. I guess a prime example is something like the Find and Treat service, currently screening across London, but with a need to screen nationally, where clearly local level commissioning doesn't necessarily serve the needs of the population. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I think the best thing that I can say is, and I might be completely wrong about this, but I just get a feeling that already people are thinking very differently about how they commission services. And I just experienced it on Monday, completely nothing to do with homelessness. I went to the sexual health clinic that's in Bedford, and I spoke with the people that are delivering that service, which is, they're very proud of the fact, and rightly so, that they have clinics in schools. And as we were just sort of chatting and talking, there was just, you could just see how people, because I think of the changes that will happen in April, are just beginning to think very differently about how they go about joining up services, how they commission those services, thinking far more freely, if you like, out of the perhaps the old NHS box, the old local authority box. So that's a feeling that I'm getting. But I think, you know, we all learn from each other, and there are undoubtedly some great commissioning going on. And what we have to make absolutely sure is that those models, those ideas are shared everywhere, so that people can learn from it and adapt or adopt them for themselves. I'm not sure if that does answer your question. If it doesn't, do forgive me. But I think it's the best I can give.
I've not been able to find anybody who can answer it yet, so I'm perhaps not surprised.
Okay.
I think we have time for one more question. I'm trying to be respectful of your time.
Okay. Yeah.
Hello, I'm Jane Gray. I'm a consultant nurse and one of the directors of Inclusion Healthcare, and we're a specialist GP service in Leicester. We became a social enterprise back in September 2010, and we used the right to request to become a social enterprise, the DOH initiative. And we did that to preserve our service, because we were fearful that with the changing landscape, that a specialist GP service just for homeless people and vulnerable groups such as ours would go on the open market, and that it would be taken over by somebody who obviously wouldn't understand the complexity of need. Now, I'm absolutely delighted that you're looking at access to GPs, and obviously wholeheartedly agree that everybody has the right to see a GP and healthcare professionals. My concern, though, is that this isn't just about access to a GP and general practice services. This is about seeing the right people who understand the vulnerability of the clients that we serve and who know about multiple and complex case management. I know that with the changing landscape, that in 2015, that myself and my colleagues are going to have to talk to yet more new commissioners and justify why a specialist GP service is needed, and that we will go through the usual pain barriers and challenges about what makes us so different. I just wondered whether what your views were on specialist GP services versus mainstream GP practices, who simply don't have the skills all the time, in fairness, because there's some fantastic mainstream services. They don't have the skills all the time to serve such a complex and vulnerable client group.
And I don't think it's... I mean, obviously, you're doing a great job in Leicester, and you're just down the road from me, and I'm sure in Nottinghamshire we'd be delighted to learn, certainly my local GP practices, from what you're doing, and certainly in the city. But I don't think it's for me to say one's better than another. What I would say is that I would hope that when people are commissioning, that they bear in mind, you know, great ideas like your own, great services like your own, so that they commission the absolutely best thing for their locality and for their areas. Again, it was really a series of excellent points, well made, and very much listened to and heard. So thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Anna Subri, and good luck with your vote.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.